Twilight Zone is sort of where our guest tonight, Lee Elders, found himself. He was told, don't stay in a particular part of the forest when he was on one of his treasure hunts. Circumstances forced him to stay there anyway, and something came out of the wilderness for him. It was evil spirits. Was it just snakes? Was it a natural phenomena? It certainly seemed weird. We'll pick up that story in a moment. I want to mention something to our message that was given to me by Ian Punnett for our Coast family. Ian, of course, our former colleague here on the program, was in Las Vegas 2 weeks ago for the National Association of Broadcasters, called me up and said, hey, can I come over? And he did. And we spent some time in the afternoon, took a tour of the TV station. He filled me in on what he was doing. He looks great, sounds great, was doing some interesting media research that he's going to write a paper about. And he wanted me to pass along his best wishes to his Coast family. So there's the message from Ian Punnett, and we certainly wish him well. We continue our conversation with Lee Elders right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Lee Elders, before the break, you were describing this amazing encounter you had one night there in the jungle after you'd been warned that the spirits didn't want you to stay there. You had to stay there anyway, and something came out of the trees. Could it be natural, I mean, in a sense, or did you think it rose to the level of something supernatural?
No. It was totally supernatural. I'd never seen anything like that before. After we got rid of the snakes by building the fire wall, we hunkered down in the crevice, and we waited, and all of a sudden across the river, right in front of us, about, I'd say, 50, 70 feet away, maybe further, we saw four balls, almost like orbs. They were orange in color with diffused white light, and they floated in. They seemed to have intelligence. They seemed to have geometry to them. And they literally stationed themselves about 20 feet above the ground and floated around, almost like they were there dictating our fate. And I asked Necta, whispered to him, I said, what are they? And he said that they were forest guardians. And he said, we're not to interfere. And then, all of a sudden, they made a circle-type move, and they dissipated right in front of our eyes. They just disappeared. But they were there a good 3 or 4 minutes. Then out of the jungle, on the opposite side of the river, came these four shadowy forms. And I couldn't see them very well because the moonlight was in the shadows there. And I asked again, what are they? And he said, they're Niawas. They're the jaguars. And they approached the river like they were going to jump in the river and come across at us. But all of a sudden they froze, stood on the opposite bank of the river. And then almost like on command, they started backing away and they went back into the jungle. Now this is about 2 o'clock in the morning. We've been on the trail for 20 hours. We've had no sleep, very little food. We're totally exhausted. And personally, my mind is fried. And so I thought, my God, what else is going to happen? And then everything became very quiet. And we did have a problem in the crevice. One of our workers was bitten by a spider. And I thought maybe one of the fertile lance types had gotten into the cave and bit him. But it wasn't. It was a spider. And he was bouncing around in pain. We finally quieted him down. And we just sort of nodded off. I woke up hours later. Everything was calm. Everything was quiet. So we got the hell out of there. And we hobbled out, I might add. And we crossed the river over to Necta's house, Wakani. And then after that, I was told that the spirits had accepted us and we could go back in and continue the exploration, and we did.
Tell me this. You know, this is something that pops up at different places in your book, the idea about greed, that the spirits, the protectors of the forest and the jungle, can sort of see into the souls of people and know what they're up to, and that a lot of explorers who've gone looking for fortune didn't come back, as you mentioned. because it looked into their heart and saw evil. It seems like the forest spirits have given you the okay, the sort of the seal of approval, but nonetheless, you had difficulties every step of the way.
We did, and Necta thought it was a Wawick. Somebody had crossed paths with in the past, and it might have been somebody was trying to get revenge on Necta. Don't know, but I do know one thing, and that is with the shaman, I had an experience. I was put through an interrogation on one of my adventures before I got up into this area, and they had a senior shaman there. He must have been over 100 years old, and I went through this inquisition with him about my motives and why I was there and what did I really want to find. And if I found anything, would I share it with the people? This type of thing. Then I heard the word heart fire. They kept referring to heart fire. And I found out later that heart fire was the way they would judge a person, or I should say, read a stranger or a person, especially a colonial like me. And the heart fire, I felt, was probably the shaman had the ability to maybe read auras. You know, you hear about aura reading here in this country and other countries, where you see this energy field around the body. And to them, the energy would be emitted from the heart area. And the heart area was the chakra of green, the green color. But if they read a good aura or heart fire with you, then they would accept you. I was accepted based on my heart fire. So that's part of the supernatural world of the Shuar. And they are unbelievable because their everyday life to them is a lie. The true life is when they take ayahuasca and they're drugged out. And that's when they talk to their spirits and, as they say, the forest guardians. But this only happens when they take ayahuasca. And at that point in time, they live their life according to what the spirits have told them. So they are very supernatural, more so than probably a lot of other tribes. And I came to learn this and also respect it. And I think that's what helped me on this expedition for the Green Fire. Without their blessing, the forest guardian and the spirit world there, I don't think I would have been allowed in. And maybe this night of the power dance, I call it, maybe that was a test to see if we would abide by not doing anything bad to the spirit world that was entering our life at that point in time.
You know, I barely touched on the name of Father Crespi, and you do go into more detail in the book, but not enough for me. I mean, there's a picture of you with this guy, Father Crespi. You're holding an artifact that appears to be from Mesopotamia, suggesting that maybe there had been some early visitors there far earlier than the Spanish conquistadors, which I hope that's the subject of a future book.
Well, I've just finished writing my second book. I'm editing it now. It's a continuation of my adventures in Ecuador. And I go into a lot of detail with Padre Crespi. But Crespi was an enigma. He had been down there for, I think, 40 or 50 years. He came in as a young man and he worked with the poor. He was from the order of poverty, the Salesiano, which is the order of poverty. And he had this museum, this old museum, was crammed full of, my God, of everything, junk, gold statues. And one day when Adriano got me in to meet him, he allowed me to film these, shall we say, antiquities that were clearly Mesopotamian in nature. And I filmed them. And I took a lot of film of everything he had as the years progressed. But he claimed that he had found them in the caves in the Oriente. He claimed that there were great cities in the Oriente, underground cities. And He was quite an enigma. Half the population revered him as a god because he was a champion of trying to eradicate poverty. And his church there took boys off the street, gave them boarding, schooling. So he was highly accepted in the community. But there were others that thought he was insane, thought he was crazy. But after seeing these artifacts, I'd have to say, and I saw a lot more, which I get into in the second book, but he had a tremendous treasure there. And it really wasn't under lock and key.
Yeah, you tell about how the boys became his eyes and ears. Let me switch gears because we only got a short amount of time in this segment left. We got about 6 or 7 minutes, but I want to talk about Billy Meier. I don't know how it is that you go from mortgage banker to treasure hunter to UFO investigator, but that's a pretty interesting series of transitions. I'll tell you, when I read about Billy Meier, it's the first UFO book I had. I thought, holy cow, look at these. It was a gift. Look at these photos. It's incredible. And then I have to be frank with you. I look at some of the later photos. I thought they looked incredibly hokey, things that were taken years later. Give me your assessment, Sora, in the next 5 minutes or so about the Billy Meier case, a brief history of how you got into it, and then what you think about it.
Okay, briefly, in the second book, I go into how I met Wendell Stevens. I sky-hiked a ride down back to Ecuador with him. That's when I first met him. We became friends. He went on several expeditions of mine. But later on, I knew that he was into UFOs, and he was sort of my mentor. He taught me a lot about them. But after Ecuador in 75, I got into some other things. I formed my own company, Intercept. But then Wendell got involved with this case in Switzerland, the Billy Meier case. And he contacted me, and he asked me if I would throw support of my investigative company, Intercept, into helping him investigate the Meier case. I was dubious. I really didn't want to switch gears at that point in time. But we had a client in England for Intercept, so I decided, Britt and I decided we'd stop by, meet Wendell at the farm, and get an assessment of this guy named Billy Meier, which we did. That was in 1978. Well, I went in sort of trying to blow the man's cover, you might say. Excuse me. And all of a sudden here I found this humble guy who was open to anything and everything, allowed us free run of everything on the farm, and started to share all of his information with us. And I couldn't come to the fact that this guy was hoaxing this stuff. I mean, because the pictures, as you know, George, they were obviously, the problem was they were too good to be true.
Yeah.
But was he using models? What was he doing? So, to make a long story short, before we left on the first trip, he gave me all of his hard evidence, which was sounds of the spacecraft he had recorded, metal that the cosmonauts had given him, metal specimens, and over 100 photographs. Plus, we had probably 30 witnesses. So we came back from there, and we started searching for scientists to do the work. This took a long time because of the stigma of the subject matter, and government laboratories certainly didn't want us in. But finally we found, and I think my moment of truth with the Meier case came with Dr. Vogel's analysis of the metal specimens.
Yeah.
I mean, that blew me away because that told me right there, okay, if we can't find anything with the photographs, and we went in to find deception, but we couldn't. The photographs kept, you know, standing up, and we were doing different tests on them. But the metal was just unbelievable. Here you had a bonding technique. You had purity of gold and silver, and in some cases, the entire periodic elements that we have on this planet. They were all separated from each other. And with the metal of the gold and silver, you had crystal, not embedded in the metal, but separated from it. Now, according to Vogel, we couldn't duplicate this with any means, any science that he was aware of. And the problem was the bonding technique. Because normally, back in those days, you would bond with heat. And when you bond with heat, then you have impurities. Everything runs together and forms together. But with the Meyer metal, it was separate in its own little world.
Let me ask you this
So,
quickly. Let me ask you this. Sorry to interrupt. The
yeah.
later photos, the wedding cake photo, they call it. I don't know. I'm not a photo analyst, but it looks incredibly hokey. It looks like ball bearings attached to some hubcaps, kind of a thing. Is it possible that somebody infiltrated Meyer, put out some other stuff under his name in order to discredit the guy? Or do you think, do you buy the credibility of those photos as well? And I'm just off base.
I had the same feeling when I first saw them. You know, because we're talking about a Generation 4 craft. Meyer filmed four different variations. We worked with three variations in science. The fourth variation, which was the wedding cake, as you call it, it came much later. And we really didn't spend a lot of time looking into those. In fact, we terminated our investigation in 82. I eventually went back in 85 with Gary Kinder. He wrote the book Light Years about, he reinvestigated our investigation.
Good book.
But,
Yeah, good book. Yeah.
yeah, but to answer your question, that's quite possible. But another thing we ran into there, we estimated that 30 to 40% of all the photographs that Billy had taken never came back to him from photo labs. I mean, he was ripped off like you can't believe. People would come in and ask if they could make a print or a copy. He would give them the original. They'd run down to the city, make a copy, and give him the copy and keep the original.
Was
He
there
was very giving, very trusting.
organized infiltration by powers that be? Don't know.
Yes, I could say that that's a strong possibility, yeah.
It just seems like the people who are in charge of muddying the waters are a lot better at this stuff than maybe even you are at getting to the truth of matters.
Absolutely. And there was so many strange things that happened in the case. We had categories. We had their third dimensional world, you know, physics and all of that, which we had to work with, and that's all we could work with. Then there was the unexplainables, which we couldn't test. And there was a lot of that stuff. Not saying that Meyer was hoaxing things. I can't see how he could have done that. Vogel said that he couldn't even duplicate the metal. The sounds were a whole nother story. You had 100 frequencies changing up and down frequency within 2 to 3 seconds. And then they reached such a level that they created a magnetism effect. This blew away Ron Shellman, the gentleman that worked with us on the sounds. But some of the photographs later on I questioned. We never tested them, and I can't say for sure if they were real or not.
I think in general it's a mistake for ufology to write off the Meyer case as so many ufologists and UFO organizations have done. Well, that you know he wouldn't they couldn't verify it, and therefore they've sort of written him off as a hoax. I think it's also probably a mistake to accept all of his stuff as being perfectly legit. It's like anything else, you take it case by case and figure it out.
Oh, you have to. For example, we had 100 photographs. We couldn't test 100 photographs. First of all, we had to find laboratories that would, or the equipment that would suffice for doing that. So we broke it down. We coded 20 photographs: sunlight scene, the log pile scene, things
Lee,
like
I'm
that.
sorry to interrupt you. I'm sorry to interrupt again, but we need to take a break. We'll come back and open up the phone lines. Hope you folks have some good questions for Lee about his book, Expeditions, Gold, Shamans, and Green Fire. One more segment to go here on Coast to Coast AM. Grand Funk, Closer to Home, bringing us closer to our final segment with my guest tonight, Lee Elders, talking about his true adventure, Expeditions, Gold, Shamans, and Green Fire. We're going to open up the phone lines with your questions for my guest. I hope you have plenty on your mind. And we'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Lee, I'm sorry I interrupted you in mid-thought there. Is there anything else you wanted to say before we wrap up the Billy Meyer discussion and move on to the phones?
Just the fact that anybody with an e-book can go to Amazon, find my book, or Barnes & Noble. It's quite available. Or they can go to my website, www.leeelders.com. Be glad to answer any questions coming through on that site as well.
Okay, let's go to the phone lines. East of the Rockies, Michael in Kansas City. Hi, Michael. You're on with Lee Elders.
Hello. How are we doing tonight?
Okay. How's it going?
Oh, very good. Really enjoyed the show tonight. Just some great stories. You know, a lot of people today are, you know, kind of stuck in a rut, dead-end job, not doing what they like. I would just like to ask Lee his advice for leading a more adventurous life.
Well, Michael, it's simple. Adventure is around every corner if you look for it. And I feel for you there. I was lucky when I started because I followed my heart, and everything worked out real well for me. But, yeah, life can become boring if you let it, but life is wonderful. And always embrace the adventures, any adventure that comes up.
Thanks, Michael. That's a thought-provoking question. I guess you have to be ready to chuck it, though, Lee, don't you? You have to be ready to walk away from what you've got. I mean, the kind of adventures you're talking about are, they come with a great cost, not only financial, but in terms of the possibility of losing your life.
Well, I was thinking more in terms of everyday adventure in a society, you know, the adventure of going hiking, or going to a great nature preserve or something like that. That's an adventure in itself. Now, I wouldn't recommend anyone chuck it and go off into the supernatural world of the Shuar, believe me.
Or to Ecuador. I mean, that's pretty, that you got to be a special person to tackle that kind of a trip.
Yeah, and you have to have a lot of luck riding with you. In fact, the title of my next book is Pushing My Luck. And it goes into a whole nother realm of adventure. So luck plays a very important part.
I wonder if you've thought of it this way, that maybe it's the quest that's the important part. The attempt is the whole point of this adventure, that the story about the emeralds is out there so that people like you, some special people like you, would try it. And it's not something that anyone is ever going to find. It's meant to inspire people to give it a try.
Well, part of my great adventure was the thrill of the hunt. I love that. When I was going to college, a bunch of buddies and I, we chopped down a car. We didn't have dune buggies back in those days. And we searched for the Lost Dutchman on the weekends. That's a fabled mine just east of Phoenix in the Lost Dutchman Mountains. And we searched for other things. Just on the weekend, had great time doing it, and that's always possible. And there's a lot of good books out called Lost Mines and Buried Treasures for those that want to search in a more civilized world, meaning Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, areas like that.
Well, Nevada, too. We've got some great stories here in Nevada, and I every time I read one of those, I want to go out and run around in the desert and try to track them down. A lot of them are bad and are completely made up, but every once in a while you hear somebody finding something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of them out there. You just have to try to find the right documentation, the right source of material, and then plan your search carefully.
Tell me this. Would you go back? You have a good life. You have a great marriage. If the right offer came along, if somebody came up with a bunch of money, let's say, let's go down and get an expedition and go back and look for those emeralds, would you go?
Can I answer that question about 3 or 4 months from now? No, in fact, Britt and I are planning on going to Ecuador probably in the fall this year, but we're not going to go back into Shuar country. We're just going to touch bases with a lot of friends there and see what progression has gone on. I know Cuenca has changed dramatically. It's become a haven for Americans my attorney friend told me that there's over 5,000 Americans now living in Cuenca in retirement. It's a great place to go now, has a great health care system. It's on the U.S. dollar currency, and it's become very progressive, much different back in the 60s when it was the Wild West.
I would think there'd be changes, too, in topography, that that the clues that might have been true in Mejia's time might not be as accurate now because rivers change course, weather changes, jungles cover things up.
That's very true. And back in the 60s when we were searching, he talked about this landslide where the emeralds were uncovered. That's referred to as a derrumbe. Well, we ruled that out real quick because the jungle is so prolific. I mean, the Incas, all they had was people trying to clear the roads of jungle that covered up the roads. So, yes, that's very correct. Rivers change courses. And not only that, but the Shuara now have a federation. And as I explained in the last chapter of the book, if you want to go in there and explore, you can't. You've got to get permission these days. The only way they'll allow you in is to hunt or take film. But to explore is off limits. And not only that, it's their land. If somebody finds them, you're going to have a partner real quick.
Yeah, I can't imagine you'd get away with, hey, I'm going to go in and look for emeralds. And they'd say, yeah, sure, go ahead. Go ahead, help yourself. First-time caller Joseph in Austin, Texas. Good morning, Joseph. You're on with Lee Elders.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. What's on your mind, Joseph?
Yeah. Lee, I was very impressed with the way you're able to sort of relive your adventures and remember all kinds of detail. You know, some people have photographic memories when it comes to reading books and things, but you seem to have a photographic memory when it comes to just living adventures. Can you explain that to us, how you have such a vivid memory of your adventures?
Oh, sure. That's fairly simple. First of all, the book took almost 7 years to write. It took 1 year of research. I was smart enough to keep a diary, keep names and notes in that diary. I also had a reel-to-reel tape recorder. Now, this was back before the microcassette and before you had camcorders and things like that. I wound up with 92 reels that I could of source material that I could go back and revisit, which I did. So, and also I took over 500 photographs. So all of this material, and also in writing the book, helped me tremendously. If I hadn't had the materials I was speaking of, I would have had a real, real tough time remembering a lot of things.
Well, did you know that you were going to be writing a book, and that's why you took such notes and such recordings? Or, I mean, it just seems like an experienced writer would maybe do something like that. But this sounds like this is your first book.
Well, it's the first book on Ecuador. I've co-authored two others.
Okay.
UFO contacts.
So you're an experienced writer.
Well, yes, I would say that. And to answer your question, no, I took the reel-to-reel. I just wanted to make notes and make sure I had a feel for everything and experience everything for later on in life. I had no idea I might be writing a book when I did this in the beginning, but I'm sure glad I did.
Yeah, I would imagine it's kind of handy to, yeah, thank you for the call. Probably handy to, if you're trying to crack a code or figure out a mystery, is to have that in addition to notes.
Oh, yes, yes. No, the diary really helped me, especially on this next book. Because, you know, you forget names. I mean, God, it's been 30, I don't know how many years now since I was there. And you forget a lot of terms and names and so forth. And luckily, I kept good records.
Yeah, I had the same thought as I'm looking at you describing this particular mountain and up down into this valley. I thought, wow, this guy's got a good memory, but that explains it. East of the Rockies, Beth in Texas. Good morning, Beth.
George, George, I wanted to comment that you're one of my favorite hosts. I wish you were on more often.
Well, thank you very much.
I get enough of you. Lee, I could almost hear or want to hear a campfire crackling while you were talking. It's just been so entertaining. I wanted to ask you specifically on the four shadows that appeared after the four balls of light. Were they, you said you couldn't see them very well. Were they shaped like jaguars, or did they change shape? Or
no, they were shaped like some form of animal. I mean, I could see like what was four legs and so forth, but I really couldn't distinguish what they were because they were in the shadows. But they had size, they had mass, and when I asked Necta, what are they, he said they were Niawas, and that's the name they use for the jaguar.
Okay, well, I'm disabled and have trouble walking around. I have a lot of leg pain and stuff, but you're inspiring me to go, you know, go walk where I can and explore more. So,
well,
I just really have enjoyed it, and I'm going to look into all of your books.
Thank you, Beth. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Beth. Appreciate it. We're going to go west of the Rockies. Jeremy in Los Angeles. Good morning, Jeremy.
Hey, good morning, George. Hey, Lee, how you doing?
Real good, Jeremy. How are you?
Good, man. I just want to say, your voice, man, it sounds like the legendary musician and mystic Utah Phillips. You know who that is?
No.
Man, well, you got to look him up. But you got a great candor about the way you explain, you know, your adventures and curiosity in life. It's really cool. So my question is this, Lee. Do you sense any connection between the UFO reality and the spiritual beings or the spiritual phenomena that you experienced in Ecuador in that cave?
Wow, that's a good question. There might be a connection. I'd have to give that some thought. That's a damn good question you just asked. Never thought of it that way.
Jeremy, this is Jeremy Corbell, isn't it?
Yeah,
I recognize your voice. Maybe you could give us your opinion and then let Lee gather his thoughts on it.
Oh, man, I'm still trying to figure that part out, but it just sounds like the way that people explain the UFO phenomenon and how they experience it, and then when people explain the spiritual experience or the entities that, you know, that Lee was talking about earlier, there seems to be, you know, some sort of connection. I mean, I think, George, you may be the better one to answer that question, but
I'm glad
Lee will think about it and let us know his opinion in the future, you know?
Well it's almost seems like, you know, sometimes the UFO mystery is trying to tell us that it's much broader and more mysterious than just flying saucers from another planet. And it takes on different forms and different kinds of hot spots. It becomes something closer to paranormal than just extraterrestrial. And it seems like that certainly is a threshold that Lee crossed down there in Ecuador. I mean, these four jaguars, whether they were actual jaguars or not, you don't have jaguars that act in unison like that, unless maybe they're trained in a circus.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And you don't have jaguars that hunt in packs, unless they're manipulated some way through what I would refer to as black magic or suggestion of somebody that's heavily involved in that, like a shaman. That might be a possibility. Jeremy's question, I want to give that some thought. That's very interesting.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. First-time caller, Evan in Missouri. Evan, what's on your mind? Hello? Oh, okay. It's Mark in Alabama, I'm told. Hi, Mark. How you doing? Hello? Well, we're having some difficulty here. Let's try. Hello. Is this Mark?
Hello?
Let's try it again. Is this Mark?
Yes, this is Mark.
You're on with Lee Elders. What's on your mind?
I wondered, you swapped gears on me. What happened to chasing the Emerald Mine? You went from Emerald Mine to UFOs.
Well,
did you ever find anything?
Oh, yeah. The last two chapters of the book, I might add that They took place in 1988. The front of the book on the preliminary search and all of that was in 1966 through 69. And in 1970s, when I went back to Ecuador, through very unusual circumstances, I couldn't get back to the Emerald search. Excuse me. And in the meantime, I got involved with UFOs.
Okay. I really enjoyed your story. I've found a couple of rubies myself up at Cherokee, up in the Carolinas. But listening to you, it just got me all excited to go rock hounding again.
There you go. There's an adventure that you can do, you know, maybe in your backyard.
Yes, sir. I appreciate your story. I really do.
Thanks for the call. Sorry to throw you for a loop there, switching to UFOs, but as we've heard, Lee Elders has led a pretty interesting life that's taken him into different kinds of mysteries all over the planet. Try to get, I don't think we can get any more calls in. Lee, tell me this. You know, as I'm reading this book, I'm thinking to myself, this would make a heck of a movie. It's not only a book, it's this is Indiana Jones. This is, what was the movie with Michael Douglas where he's chasing a big emerald?
Oh, that was Romancing the Stone.
Romancing the Stone.
Great movie. Excuse me, my voice is failing. But, yeah, I agree with you. And perhaps we'll get some interest in that area.
You and your wife, Britt, are friends with Shirley MacLaine. It seems to me she'd have some contacts in Hollywood, right?
Oh, she has a lot, yeah. But, you know, friendships, we don't ask for anything like that, and that's why we're friends. And but she's got the book. She's reading it, so we'll see what happens.
Is Intercept still up and running? Do you still operate that company?
No, not really. It's sort of obsolete today based on what NASA and other entities are doing with their personal privacy. But back in the 70s and 80s, it was a very powerful company, but that was before technology jumped light years ahead and eliminated the electronic countermeasure stuff.
That's a pretty sad testament that you had a company based on trying to provide online security for people, and now it's a foregone conclusion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the technologies are going jumping, yeah.
Lee Elders, I really enjoyed the book, Expeditions, Gold, Shamans, and Green Fire. I hope you'll come back when the second volume comes out.
Hey, I'll let you know, George, and I hope you're the first show I do.
Let's count on it, and I look forward to it. Thanks for being with us. Thanks also
Thank you,
to
George.
Thanks to Nathan Staten, Gina Salvati, Dan Galanti, our webmaster Lex Lonehood, our producer Chris Boros, my first guest, Paul Fronczak, and, of course, Lee Elders. I will be back next weekend, Saturday and Sunday. Hope you can tune in. We're working on some pretty good shows for next weekend. Good night, everyone.